It's one of the great ironies of climate change that the globe's coldest places are warming the fastest. That one simple statement reflects an enormous body of research conducted in Antarctica and around the Arctic. That research is logistically difficult and often downright uncomfortable for the people involved. But Earth's icy poles are also strikingly beautiful and alluring. Chris Linder is a scientist-turned-award-winning science photographer. Over the past 10 years, he's photographed more than 30 science expeditions, including 16 to the polar regions. Four of those expeditions are featured in a new hardcover photography book, Science on Ice, Four Polar Expeditions. Chris joins us now to tell some of the stories you don't usually read or hear about in the mainstream media coverage of polar research. I'm so glad you could be here, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
So, you didn't start off as wanting to be a photographer as a child or whatever. You actually went and got your master's degree from the MIT Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution Joint Program and were on track to become a scientist when you somehow discovered that your true calling was science photography. How did that transition happen?
Yeah, that was really interesting, and I could have never predicted it from the start. In 2000, when I started working at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, I joined as a technician, and my job was to go out to sea and help the scientists get these unwieldy instruments over the side, bring them back onto the ship, and take the data and work up the data, create plots, help write papers and things like that. But when you're out on a research ship at sea, you see some amazing things. And you see, you know, not just the things that are happening outside the ship, like, you know, dolphins playing off the ship, beautiful sunsets. But there's also the beauty of people working hard, dedicated to what they're doing. There's this intensity that oceanographers and the people who are on the ships, the crew, have when they're working. So I took pictures of them in my free time when I was not on watch. And those photographs were used later in annual reports for Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. We did a calendar early on, and I realized that there was a real power in this imagery, and there was I was kind of opening up this hidden world that that nobody was really privy to, right? The public doesn't get to see what happens when you're out at sea for 30 days on an oceanographic expedition.
You know, I think it's interesting. I've seen lots of scientists' photos when they come back from, say, a trip to Antarctica. And actually, most of what they're photographing as well is off of the boat, maybe just taking for granted that what they're doing on the ship is work and not necessarily drudgery, but not the interesting part. They're taking pictures of the scenery and the dolphins. And it's interesting to me that you were able to kind of step away from that, to get the perspective to actually say, oh, well, what's going on right here? This work is actually interesting, too.
Yeah, I think that stories in particular, when we try to, you know, and I got a big break in 2002. Bob Pickart, a scientist in the Physical Oceanography Department, recognized that I had this intense interest in telling these science stories. And so he gave me this incredible opportunity to go on a 3-year project to the Arctic with him, a month every summer for 3 summers in a row, and actually not just take pictures, but write a blog, which at the time, you know, I don't think blog was even a big term in the public lexicon, and code the website myself, all from Etsy, take the pictures, update it, do all that. And I learned a lot from that experience. And one of them was how to use images to tell stories. And it's not just about the pretty pictures, but it's about, you know, the pictures that kind of fill in the blanks in between these beautiful moments that are important for actually telling the story. You know, and it's people, too, that drive these stories. You know, I think that as human beings, we like to hear these stories from people, and people are great conveyors of these stories. A lot of the things I'm photographing, especially early on, was a lot of physical oceanography. It's difficult to get a photograph of, say, an ocean current or, you know, data that's coming in. But when you see somebody's face and their intensity on their face, or they're, you know, they're involved in their work or handling instruments, that can be a vehicle for telling the story in a way that you can help kind of communicate things that are otherwise invisible.
Now, you said in the introduction to Science on Ice that your first trip to the Arctic, I believe it was, really sparked a love affair with the polar regions. What is it about these really, you know, fairly harsh, hard to get to, hard to be in places that is so alluring?
Well, it's just something about the ice that's, for lack of a better word, it's just magical. And I know other people have fallen under this spell. When you get up there, and, you know, when you get up to the Arctic, and you're on a boat and just the smells are different. You know, the air is different. Everything is different about this environment. You really do feel like you get this sense of being on another planet. And you, you know, you're surrounded by this floating ice. It's just so unnatural compared to, you know, if you've been on a boat anywhere else in the world, when you look out and see ice floating on the water, and there may be, you know, walruses sitting on these ice floes or polar bears swimming between them, it just blows you away. And at that point, it was all I could do to get on every single project I could to go north or south.
Well, and as I said earlier, you've now photographed, I believe, 16 of these polar expeditions, both to both poles. So, although not necessarily to the actual poles, but to Antarctica and to the Arctic. So you've been to both ends of the Earth. Do you have a favorite?
That's tough. I have to say that probably my favorite place in the world is Cape Crozier on Ross Island, a favorite place I've been so far, I should say. This is a home to 500,000 Adélie penguins. And it's a remarkable place on this kind of windswept slope on the east side of Ross Island. You come over this hillside and spread out before you are these valleys of just penguin after penguin after penguin. And the sound, this kind of deafening roar of the voices of these penguins hits you. And you realize that you could have been standing here 10,000 years ago and see exactly the same thing. There's absolutely no trace of humanity at all. Once you step over that ridge and you're just watching these birds do what they do year to year, raise their young, you know, fight off South Polar skuas, you know, and then at the end of the year, go back to the sea where they spend 9 months of the year. It's just an incredible sight, not to mention the smells as well. It's kind of like a fishy barnyard.
Not necessarily the most appealing
of
ideas, but I'm talking with science photographer Chris Linder about polar research. You can see examples of his photographs on our website. Go to capeandislands.org and click on Living Lab. You can also join our conversation by calling 866-999-4626 or emailing us at livinglabradio@wgbh.org. You can also tweet us at Living Lab Radio. So let's talk a little bit more about Antarctica. Even just getting there is a story and really an adventure in and of itself. So you start in New Zealand on these enormous transport planes. And there's one photograph of in the book of the inside of the C-17 Air Force transport plane where, I mean, the whole middle of it actually starts to look a little bit like a regular plane that the rest of us are flying, a commercial jet. It's got like five seats down the middle, all the way down, and packed with people. But these are enormous, enormous planes. How comfortable is it to be on there, really? I mean, it looked more comfortable than I was expecting for a transport plane.
Yeah, it's an amazing experience being on those planes. C-17s are remarkably configurable, I guess. So that middle section, I've been on those flights before where that middle section is a drill or a vehicle, a tracked vehicle, you know, that they can just drive right in and park and tie down kind of in the middle. So sometimes you're just sitting along the sides of the plane. My big regret as a photographer is there's not enough windows, because as you're flying down in that C-17, you're passing this amazing strip of coastline out the right side of the window. And there's only one tiny, or maybe two tiny little porthole sized windows on the side of the plane. And of course, as soon as we see land and ice, I'm glued to one of those windows. And, you know, most of the other scientists are old hands. They're just kind of reading books or sleeping or whatnot for the five-hour flight. But I am just glued to that window because the sight of these mountains and glaciers unfolding underneath you as you fly down to McMurdo is just a breathtaking sight.
And it seems like there's possibly a couple layers of culture shock as you go from the real world, if you want to call it that, from New Zealand, modern-day culture, to Cape Crozier. No hint of humanity, essentially, except for a small hut and all these penguins. And McMurdo is the stop along the way. And the photo you have of it from the air is really quite shocking. I mean, it looks kind of like an ugly warehouse district, essentially, from the air. And you say in the book that it is very shocking to get to McMurdo, that it's got its own culture, its own kind of society, and that varying... You spend varying degrees of time there, depending on how many times you've been to Antarctica and how much time you need to make that transition out into the wilds of Antarctica. I mean, what are you doing at McMurdo?
Yeah, McMurdo is the kind of logistical hub. And so as such, thousands of people pass through there in the summer, researchers that are getting from, you know, and this is an incredible job, really, for the people I have an amazing respect for the people who work there. Their job is to take these researchers, some of whom have never been to Antarctica before. They come in, they need to get them prepared to be camping out in the wilds in one of the, basically one of the most remote and dangerous places in the world. So they take them from being off of a plane in the middle of summer in New Zealand, and you got to be ready to endure, high winds, cold temperatures, get ready for any number of hazards that they may encounter doing their work. And so it's just a hum of activity. Helicopters are coming and going all day. You hear this beeping, constant beeping of these loaders backing up. You know, it's a dry place. Antarctica's a desert because it doesn't get a lot of precipitation. So there's dust blowing down the streets in these big clouds. So it's a crazy place. It kind of feels a little Wild West when you're there. And it's just intense for the time that you're there. You know, the goal in, for me, when I get to McMurdo is to get out of McMurdo as fast as possible. Cause you want to get into the field, wherever your field location is. And I think that most researchers probably feel the same way, but, McMurdo is just, it's just an amazingly efficient place, I guess, among other things.
I think one of my 5-year-old's favorite photographs in your book is of the simulated rescue in whiteout conditions, where they stick buckets over people's heads to simulate the blindness and I guess the whiteness of being in whiteout conditions.
It's amazingly effective to simulate a whiteout. Go ahead. You can do this at home. Go ahead and take a bucket and put it on your head and start walking around outside. You'll quickly realize how difficult it is to orient yourself as to what direction you're going and to hear anything, which is really what it's like when you're in a roaring storm, trying to find somebody. And that was the drill. Really, I think the point of the drill was that if you are in your tent and you really have to go to the bathroom, you use your pee bottle and you don't try to go out to the latrine if you're in a blinding whiteout. Because if you go out there and you get lost, it's extremely difficult for anybody to come find you. And the drill we did was to have 10 people say, okay, somebody's gone out to the bathroom. They haven't come back in a half hour or something. So it's time to go look for them. So you take this rope and everybody puts a bucket on their head and you go outside. And inevitably, within about 5 minutes, the line is completely tangled. Everybody's just bunched up in a ball. And at that point, you realize you have to start over. And it takes forever to try to do an actual sweep where you're trying to find somebody who may be laying on the ground. We never did it right.
Not an encouraging thought as you're headed out to Cape Crozier.
It just shows you respect for the environment, if nothing else.
Now, a lot of the scientists that you went out to Cape Crozier with and went out to these different penguin colonies with have been doing this year after year after year, and sometimes together. It seems like they've probably got kind of special relationships. I mean, they're spending months out there together. And in fact, two of the researchers you were there with just gets a brief mention in the book. By the way, these two are married. Did they meet in Antarctica, or is this something that they met and got married and one brought the other into? Or
I'm actually not sure if the penguin researchers were married before they got there, but they're not the only ones I know who are not only penguin researchers, but are also married and sometimes go into the field together. When you're there for 3 months at a time, being away from your family is really, really hard. And so I think these relationships form if people are unmarried from the get-go. And these relationships can be very, very strong because they're, in the field working together, and they're not suffering this separation anxiety that, I suffer from when I'm in the field, being away from my family. The day's ticking by. Once you get to the 6 or 7 week point, I start to go a little batty myself. Just from being away from my my wife and my kids.
You do have, at least these days, the benefit of a lot of modern communication, though, even when you're out in the field. I mean, you had people blogging from the field on a lot of these expeditions. In fact, there's a great photo of one of the writers actually posting on his computer from a little tiny ice cave. So, I mean, that seems to me incredible, the amount of work and infrastructure that must go into just maintaining that kind of communication with the rest of the world, and must really change the experience as well.
Yeah, I've had mixed communications, I guess, for every place I've been. It's been a little bit different. And that photo you mentioned is probably the most extreme example of us getting a blog post out. For the project that wound up becoming this book, you know, it was a National Science Foundation funded project to communicate live from the field. And so our goal in each expedition I was on, I was with a different science writer, and every day we would sort through the 800 or 1,000 photos I'd taken and select 8, and then I'd have to get those 8 back to Woods Hole to the web designers to put online. And sometimes it would take 2 hours to transmit 8 web-sized photos that you could send on your iPhone from Woods Hole in probably 2 minutes. So sometimes this was an incredibly frustrating experience. You know, I was working with technology that was portable because we have to be able to carry it into the field, and reliable. And the only system that works globally is Iridium satellite. And, you know, it's the handset actually looks like one of those old cell phones that you used to have in your car in like the 70s or 80s, this big chunky handset. And the modem is this tiny little thing you clip on the bottom. And that was probably the slowest technology we ever had to use. And thankfully, not for that long, because at the end of a day, the last thing you want to see is watching the dial-up screen. And it's about the 10th the speed of dial-up for those who remember that, for when we used to access the internet that way.
While we're on the topic of technology, what do you do to keep your cameras functional in that kind of extreme cold? I mean, I guess in Antarctica, at least it's dry, but the Arctic is much more humid and also cold. Do they have to be in special cases? What do you do to take care of your cameras?
Well, they've been digital is remarkably cold friendly. I've used, for example, with film, if you take film down to minus 40, it starts to crack inside it gets very brittle and cracking is a real big issue. Digital cameras, as long as they have a big, solid, chunky battery and a lithium battery, and you swap them out frequently, they work very, very well. So what I'll have is one battery inside my jacket, keeping it warm, and the camera is, you know, outside my jacket working away, firing away frames. The worst situation I've encountered is being in minus 40 conditions in the Arctic and having the small amount of lubricant that's in the camera that drives that mirror that goes up and down, having that freeze. And so sometimes having the mirror get stuck. And that's only been after, say, being out in minus 40 for 6 hours or so. And about that time, the rest of my body's ready to quit anyway. So it's time to go in and warm up. Anyway, so the cameras do remarkably well. And they, like you said, the environment is so dry in most of these places, especially when it's that cold, that you really don't have to worry about moisture issues, rain, and stuff like that. I'd rather have cold than rain.
So obviously you're using digital, not film. Mm-hmm. But what kind of camera do you use? Or how many? I guess you've probably got a few different ones for different situations.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, the right tool for the right job. And in a lot of cases, I use Nikon digital equipment, as a variety of lenses, underwater housings if the project calls for it, audio equipment, audio recorders to record sounds. It just depends on the job, kind of which tool I'm going to need. But the big chunky Nikon professional bodies are what's needed when it gets really, really cold.
I'm talking with science photographer Chris Linder about polar research. You can join our conversation by calling 866-999-4626. You can also send us an email at livinglabradio@wgbh.org or tweet us at livinglabradio. Now, 3/4 of your new book, Science on Ice, is actually not about Antarctica. It's about the Arctic. And I wonder, actually, why is it not more evenly split? Why is 3/4 of it about the Arctic? Is it just easier to get to those different places, or did you find there were more stories to tell there?
Well, yeah, when we started out this project, it was we had started by communicating, and this was back in 2006, actually, when we wrote this proposal, and it was, you know, I was working at Woods Hole, and we were Woods Hole Oceanographic, and so we wanted to get a diversity both of the kind of subject matter. So we wanted to cover a different discipline, engineering, you know, biology, geology. We wanted to really spread that out and show the diversity of what polar science is, because polar science really is a very generic term and encompasses all sorts of different subdisciplines of science. And so we really wanted to kind of spread that out. And I think I would have liked to have gone south more than once during the trip, but it just wound up that we selected projects that 3 of them wound up being Arctic, 1 in Greenland, 2 on icebreakers, but both in very different places. 1 icebreaker trip in the springtime to the Bering Sea, into the seasonal ice there, and another trip up to the very high Arctic north of Svalbard in the middle of summer. And that was looking at, again, a completely different subject matter. This was an exploratory trip looking at the Gackle Ridge, this kind of seam spreading center on the bottom of the Arctic Ocean that no one had ever looked at before.
It was really interesting to me in looking at the four different chapters, the four different expeditions. The chapter about Antarctica, really, it's the people and the penguins seem to dominate your photographs. And you get to the Arctic, and actually these icebreakers that you're on seem to have personalities of their own almost. There are these really striking photographs, the Healy in particular. I mean, it's this 400-foot-long, bright red boat, so it's kind of striking to look at in the background of white ice anyway, but it just seems to have a real personality, almost domineering personality of its own. It features in so many of the photographs, just the boat itself.
Yeah, they do have. They have different characters there. I've been on a Canadian icebreaker, a Swedish icebreaker, a U.S. icebreaker. They're all totally different. The crew is different. The way that the science is done is a little bit different from each one. And the researchers will tell you the same thing. You know, you have to get used to working on this platform, but it's more than that. It's a floating home. And so, and really when you're on an icebreaker, it is your home. You're not just working on this vessel, but you're sleeping and eating with everybody on that ship for sometimes 40 to 60 days, you know, when you're on this boat. And so it becomes your second home when you're on it. And so you get used to this kind of schedule of the meals and you make friends with the crew and the scientists, and it really becomes a bonding experience that's hard to make an analogy to unless you've been in the military and been on a boat in a situation like that. That's kind of the closest thing I could put it to, is that you really have this bonding experience with people on board.
You know, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the sounds and the emotions of being on an icebreaker, because you mentioned in the book that, you know, most of the time when you're on a boat, a jarring movement and a really loud bang are really bad things. And it's almost intuitive to have those seem really bad, especially when you're on a boat. But that just is the norm when you're banging into ice day and night.
Yeah. And it's the first time you hit ice. I mean, it takes you aback. I mean, you're very surprised. The boat can move. It can lurch. You realize how strong this vessel must be to pound into something that's like solid rock and bounce off. And in some cases, when you're on an icebreaker, and if you're in heavy ice, you may not be able to break through the ice. You may have to go around. And, you know, in talking with the ice pilots and the people who are driving these vessels, and many times you look at the track of where we've been as we go through the ice, and it looks like the ship is drunk, you know, or the ship operator's drunk, and the line is kind of squiggling this way and that through the ice. It's not a straight path. And that's because the easiest way through the ice is to not hit the ice at all. And so they try to do, you know, when they're driving the boat, they do everything they can to not hit that ice and to go around it, particularly the large floes. But sometimes it's unavoidable. And then they'll have to do what's called backing and ramming. Literally, if you're trying to get through a floe and the ship doesn't make it, they'll back way up and then charge at it as fast as they can and try to ram it and break that ice to get through. But it can be quite a process. And loud, and sometimes hard to sleep.
I can imagine. Now, in one of the expeditions to the Arctic, you were actually, as you mentioned earlier, trying to map the sea floor. And to do that, you not only had your icebreaker, but then you had remotely operated vehicles that you were launching from the ship. And based on the photographs, it seems like an immense amount of time and effort went into recovering these vehicles. Now, I know that Hanu Singh from Wotol Oceanographic Institution, who is one of the lead engineers on these, has told me at one point they designed them to be not quite disposable, but knowing that they were going on very high-risk missions. These are relatively inexpensive ROVs, vehicles. But still, just the amount of time and effort, how many different ways, if you tried to count it up, how many different ways did you have to go about getting these vehicles back from underneath the ice?
Oh, probably at least half a dozen different ways, many involving helicopters. And, you know, it's the thing that when you put something in the ocean, you don't always expect that the ocean's going to give it back, you know, and this was the extreme case of that. Normally, if you're in open water and you send out an autonomous vehicle, You know, they're all designed to float if something goes wrong. And when these things, when they float up to the top, usually you can see it. In this case, if you've got this layer of ice on top, not only is it going to hide it from view, but also as these flows jumble together, they can easily crush one of these instruments like, you know, in like an egg in your hand, just smash it right to bits. And this is, you know, years and years of engineering, years and years of planning went into the mission. And so as soon as that vehicle is coming to the surface, it's a scramble to find it, to get it safely back onto the ship, out of the ice. And so, you know, we had people in, say, in this crane baskets going over, and in some cases, in other cases, helicopters were used. In one case, they actually landed the helicopter on a small ice floe, no bigger than the sweep of the rotors of the helicopter itself. Co-pilot ran out and attached a line to the AUV, and they just lifted it right up with the helicopter out of the ice and brought it to a safe location.
Now, trying to cram all four of these expeditions into one book was probably challenge enough, but we've been trying to cram it into half an hour. And so I just want to quickly, in the last few minutes we have here, touch on Greenland. There's the one chapter in the book is about the melting at the surface of the glacier and the lakes that form and how that contributes to the movement and melting of the glaciers as a whole. And I know you were back in Greenland again this summer. There were headlines this summer that the vast majority of the entire surface of Greenland's ice sheet, something like 97% of the surface, all melted, unprecedented in 30 years of satellite measurements. I wonder how different it seemed actually being there those two different times. And just in general, going back again and again to these polar regions, how much change you've seen yourself in the past 10 years?
Yeah, that's a good question. And a lot of people ask that question too. And in this case in Greenland, I wasn't there at exactly the same time of year that I was there in 2008. At that time, it was July and August. It was really the height of the melt of the ice. This year, we were there in May, and so the melt hadn't really started happening. But yet, at the same time, when I was there, it was the hottest it had been in that month in Greenland on record. And so we're walking around in town in t-shirts and flip-flops and, you know, going out to dinner in flip-flops. Granted, I like it a little bit colder anyway, probably more than most average people. But still, the difference in the climate was notable, you know, and the temperature and the daily weather was amazing at the time.
Chris Linder is a freelance science photographer whose images are featured in the new book Science on Ice: Four Polar Expeditions. Chris, I'm so glad you were able to be here today.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
Chris will be speaking and sharing his photographs at several events around the region this week. You can find information about those, a link to information about those on our website. Go to capeandislands.org and click on Living Lab. This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Dan Treidel and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR station, a service of WGBH.